And I call on Frank Stenson to address us on the Anglo-Saxon coinage and historians.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, this is a special occasion in the history of this society, and it gives me the greatest pleasure that by your kindness I am present at it. I better say at once what indeed may be only too evident as I go on, that I have no pretensions to being a numismatist. I started as a collector of coins in the schoolboy stage, and with advancing years, I have been more and more definitely obliged to take numismatic evidence into account. For a long time I've been concerned with the problems of old English history, and I shall speak to you tonight purely, of course, from that point of view. And I really think the time has now come at which that point of view may not be unprofitable. Through the work of numismatists, of collectors, of museum specialists, and the like, a situation has now been reached at which the historian concerned with Anglo-Saxon England is compelled, whether he likes it or not, to take notice of the main conclusions which are indicated by the study of coins. That development has come about, I think, very rapidly. It is not so long ago that historians, if they interested themselves in coins at all for this period, regarded them rather as matters of decoration, of ornament, and of illustration to a historical discourse. At the present time, the reverse has happened. Nowadays, any historian who wishes to be at all complete in any portion of his study of the Anglo-Saxon period must try and work the numismatic evidence into a consideration of his main theme. For at every turn, in the 400 or 500 years before 1066, historical questions arise which are illustrated and sometimes, perhaps happily, are brought near a solution when they are brought into connection with the numismatic evidence. The converse is equally true. And I think one may say this, certainly, from the historical point of view, one may say it, the need for a conscious and continuous alliance between numismatists and historians has never been so urgent. After that preliminary, one must say in honesty and fairness to our predecessors, that it has always been realized that coins often fill out the outline supplied by written materials. One could multiply examples to almost any extent, and the value of coins from that point of view is increasing with every day that a new coin is found or that a new analysis has made an existing coin series more plain. To give merely a casual selection of illustrations, let us take, or might take, the most obscure King Baldred of Kent. The chronicle says, the Anglo-Saxon chronicle, that he was driven from Kent across the Thames in 825, when Kent came into the possession of Wessex. A charter, as distinct from a chronicle, records that a certain grant was revoked in a later generation because that grant was only made by King Baldred when he was actively in the course of flight. Well, I'm probably out of date here, but at any rate, we do know that Baldred of Kent struck coins, and that he'd 8 distinct moneyers working for him. And I think that 8 coin ovens make a really effective kingdom. And then, take the case of a man whose counterfeit presentment is going round the room at this moment, Charles II, King of Mercia, the last king of the old independent Mercian state. In old days, if historians mentioned him at all, he was a discreditable figure of fun and nothing more. He was the foolish king's thane, as the West Saxon Chronicle calls him, who made what we should nowadays, I suppose, regard as a treasonable bargain with heathen Danes, and was by then, under very onerous conditions, placed on the Mercian throne. One late source, late 10th century source, just tells us that he reigned for 5 years, but adds nothing to that. That's the literary evidence. Record evidence, namely charters, show him acting as a recognized sovereign. So show him behaving as a normal king. Show him, in particular, making what I can only regard as an alliance with the Bishop of Worcester, by which he emancipated the ministers under the Bishop of Worcester's control from the heavy burden of providing food, pastus for the king's horses and for those who took the king's horses about the country. We also know from record evidence that he fell into the ordinary Mercian series, and that his kingdom included a generate the southern half of what was afterwards known as English Mercia. Will then coins come in as a third source of evidence? They show him continuing the Mercian series, and here I may of course be wildly wrong, one can speak what one knows. I really cannot but think that his coins definitely make an improvement on those of his predecessor, King Burghred. At any rate, I know.
Okay. No, leave that alone.
That I saw in the locket collection. And the coin that is going round now from Wallis and Peter Hoard would, I would suggest, be a fine piece if it hadn't been buried for 50 years and if someone hadn't knocked a hole in it. You see, you can build up some sort of picture of this most obscure and unfortunate king by combining your major authority, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, with the charters which were issued in the time and the coins which the king put forth. And, of course, having mentioned Chelvolt II, I would merely make the observation so familiar to all of you that he is one of the three persons who contributed to what I might call the mystery of the two emperors. After all, he did strike. Why, when, and how, I don't know. What is perhaps the most remarkable, and certainly to my mind the most difficult single coin in the whole of the Saxon series, and equally yoked with the Dane King Halfdan and King Alfred of Wessex. Well, now, coins, of course, fill in the outline that written materials supply us with. The coins, of course, will sometimes confirm literary sources. I always think myself the most remarkable, quite conclusive piece of confirmation that one gets from coins of a late recorded historical fact is that which is afforded by the coins of King Raedwulf of Northumbria, whose existence is otherwise, as the British Museum catalogue tells us, volume 1, is only recorded by the 13th century chronicler Roger of Wendover. Roger of Wendover, This point was already made by Leward in his great edition of Matthew Paris, great Victorian work. Roger Wendover, a deplorable person, but still an assiduous searcher out of materials, undoubtedly possessed with a little other evidence that we do not now own, a set of northern annals recording mainly the accessions and deaths of kings of Northumbria for a period between approximately 810, 815 and 975. He tells us that King Ethelred the second of Northumbria, whose name appears on such innumerable stickers, was deposed in 844, was succeeded by a king named the Red Wolf, who, in the course of his first year, was defeated in battle by a Danish army, was killed together with one of his aldermen, the alderman Alfred. The British Museum catalogue in recording Wedolf's existence is a little apologetic about it, and does observe in the footnote that he is only known from Roger of Wendover. Quite a proper note, of course. Only, thanks, in the first place, to Dr. Leward, and most recently, Professor Dorothy Whitelock, we now know that Roger of Wendover has preserved for us the substance of a set of annals written, I think undoubtedly, by people belonging to York Minster, which has otherwise disappeared without trace. Well, I do not know how many maniers struck stickers for King Red Wolf. The number is surprisingly large. And the reality of the evidence which Roger of Wendover did possess is placed beyond doubt. And then, more important, is the way in which numismatic evidence is affecting our conception of major problems in Anglo-Saxon history. To take a most elementary point, surely our knowledge of what it is still perhaps convenient to call the Heptarchy in its last years is affected by the fact that the coins of the various Heptarchic kingdoms other than Northumbria circulated together, or at least were hoarded together. After all, in the very last days of the old Mercian kingdom, the Croydon hoard, if I am right, or if Mr. Corbett Anderson wasn't wrong, included coins, Burghred of Mercia, Alfred of Wessex, three East Anglian kings, ending with Edmund, and a miserable piece, I think it's a split penny, isn't it, of Chelnoth Archbishop of Canterbury. In other words, what Bede and the rest of them used to call the kingdoms of the southern English do seem, from this point of view, to have formed a single economic unit. But of course that, and all the other illustrations that I ventured to suggest, are quite trivial matters when they're compared with the importance of the numismatic evidence for the last 90 plus years of the Anglo-Saxon state. For there, the evidence of coins is suggesting conclusions, I think, undoubtedly convincing, which give a new sharpness of definition to our whole conception of the Anglo-Saxon state in the last generations before the conquest. I won't go into details of which you will be much more familiar at first hand than I. But surely we should all agree on the evidence of the coin series, beginning with the last type of Edgar, that England from 973 or 4 down to, shall I say, October 1066? Or should I say, December the 1st, 1135, possessed a managed currency. A currency controlled by a centralized authority and decentralized in distribution and exchange to a degree which is most remarkable. For the decentralization of issue is a fact which must have drawn many persons, it certainly attracted myself, to the study of this coinage. And recent work on mints, non-moneys, is providing, what one mustn't overestimate, but is a quite genuine new line of approach to the public economy of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom. I mean, it may seem, if you like, a small matter that this town has 6 moneys, each of whom goes from one type to another. And another town has, let us say, 12 moneys also going from one type to another. One mustn't say, of course, in so many words, that the second town must have been twice as important as a centre of exchange as the first. But evidence of that kind, which is increasing in volume day by day, does give you a rough, an elementary index, as I see it, to the relative importance of the various Anglo-Saxon boroughs. It's a small thing, if you like, but a small result, you know, is better than no result at all. And that's what we've got without this evidence. But then, I suppose, most important of all, is the work that is being done now, and done so quickly that a person in the country like myself can really not keep equal to it, on the succession of types. Keed, and here Mr. Dolly is leading the way, keyed into the Scandinavian finds, uniform generally, surely I write her, in execution, at all mints except York. I must always make a reservation, I think, for York. And showing such a uniformity that really we can only agree, I think, with the statement of Doomsday Book that at the end of the reign of Edward the Confessor, at any rate, how long before, who shall say, there was a distribution of dyes from a central sort of atelier in London. Well, now, of course, familiar as that is to all numismatists, it is only quite lately, in the past, I should think, 10, 20 years, but historians have come to realize that there is a fact which must govern our conception of the character of the old English state. After all, this centralization of currency agrees with what we are beginning to learn about that state in other directions. The last generation work on that field is largely devoted to and concentrated on the working out of the pre-conquest scheme of national taxation. I myself, when I just emerged from university, was set under Mr. J. Horace Round to work out the Doomsday assessment of the counties which I knew upon the ground. And mainly through Round, one can now see with some definiteness the precision, the accuracy, the centralized control which the government of the country, or if you like, the king in council, exercised over the assessment and collection of the Danegeld. Well, that fits in, don't you see, to a centralized currency. And just as, I would think, the work of the past generation found its most definite expression in the settlement of these assessment problems, the Danegeld and similar payments, well, the work of this generation is demonstrating centralization of a currency and showing that that is no less as complete in its way as the centralization of national taxation. And then again, of course, matter of just a few years ago, we now know, thanks to Dr. Florence Harmer, that the clerks in the King's service had developed the informal letters which passed between King's subjects in earlier ages into the formalities of the King's writ, which has been described as the most efficient method of publishing the will of a sovereign to his subject, which had hitherto been discovered in Western Europe. Well, the king's writ, the king's taxes, the king's money, they all tell the same story. A state which, whatever its weakness, it had many weaknesses, was, at any rate, functioning with an efficiency to which it would not be easy to find an exact parallel at that time in Western Europe. I believe, I hope, I trust, we should all accept that. That's part of a familiar body of doctrine about English numismatics. But you know, it's difficult to realize, I think, how recently one has been able to feel quite comfortable about it. The regular succession of types, what should we say, 3 or 4 years, already under Ethelred II, is one of the basic facts in connection with the currency. Yet, if you take that book, I shall have to refer to it again, but it's a book which is a sort of Bible for those whom I know who have begun this study, Mr. Brooks' English Coins. When that book was published, isn't it, 1932, the small cross type of Ever Read Beyond Ready was one and indivisible, and that type was issued, Dr. Brooke is quite definite on that point, continuously throughout the reign. Now I can speak with feeling here. I wanted to use these coins, I had occasion to use these coins in a survey search I had to make of Anglo-Saxon history. You've no idea how paralyzing it was when you were trying to do that, to have these beastly Ethelred II short cross pieces, mass-produced and horrible, running right through the whole reign. You see, it made nonsense of that orderly succession of types. Men of science, in the narrow sense, would, I think, quite rightly, make much of a discovery equal in significance to the separation of the martyr type of Ethelred from the rest. And although the appearance of the second small cross ever read has complicated the situation somewhat, now, as in the second edition of Mr. Brooke, one does see quite clearly that there was a fundamental distinction between really rather attractive, though slightly lunatic, first chalk cross type Ethelred II and the mass-produced monstrosities of the time when Canute was abroad in
in Berlin.
That is, I think, rather a good illustration of what a single discovery can do. You may say, you must have been extraordinarily foolish not to spot the difference between these martyr-type pieces and the last short cross pieces. Then these martyr-type pieces don't seem so very common. And my own knowledge of them and of Edward the Martyr's own coins is almost entirely due to the opportunity I had of looking at Dr. Hill's great Lincoln collection, which has made a sort of core in Edward the Martyr to all our profit. One more point, and I must leave this reformed coinage, otherwise I shall go no further. Of course, we want to be more definite at innumerable points. We want to register more individual coins. And here, of course, the Sillige, the Anglo-Saxon coins, now, can I say, in the course of coming from Chris, is going to provide an invaluable basis for future work. Every new mania matters. Every variety of type matters. And this work is going forward. Before I leave this currency, this last currency, with all its implications, pointing to the centralization of Anglo-Saxon monarchy, one word about its importance in the history of English art, a subject that may quite profitably be opened in the Warburg Institute. We're always apologetic about the late old English coins. Dr. Brooke again. The workmanship, he says, of the coins falls to a level of adequate but spiritless efficiency. The designs are carefully but heavily engraved. The striking of the coins is good. Well, it's a compliment to the currency, of course, really. It's a sort of left-handed compliment that one doesn't always like. And I'll only criticize one word, and that word is spiritless. Surely, from time to time, in this late old English currency, you come across a coin which has been struck and preserved under the best possible conditions. Struck from a good die by a careful workman. And I always think myself to realize that these coin types, coin profiles, coin portraits, if one may so call them, do illustrate just that character of spirit, of energy, which, as Professor Wormald has shown to demonstration, is such an outstanding character of late old English drawing. Those types, I always call them the shorthand heroic types, king in armor, king helmeted, and so on. The Ethelred, second of Canute, have of the first, even the beginning of it, the Confessor, may have many defects of an artistic sort. I'm not competent to speak about them. But they do, unless my eyes have deceived me every time, they do show that essential quality, vitality, which is, I suppose, really, you know, the ultimate distinction of late old English art, which passed over under English influence even to the continent, and which, of course, you get transcendently displayed in the Bayeux tapestry. So that I don't feel at all apologetic about the late old English coins, even from the artistic point of view. But what I would like to see is a volume illustrating most carefully selected specimens of this coinage. Perfectly legitimate to select your specimens, which, and so it shouldn't be a frightfully expensive book to produce, which would place beyond doubt, for not only the historical, but the general reader, the merit and, for that matter, the demerit also, of the coinage of this age. Well, now we go to earlier periods than this. Maybe that the recent contribution of numismatics to history has been less central or less spectacular. And there are problems on which the coins of the time raise more questions than they solve. The mystery of Coverdale is still a very crucial mystery. May have been brought a little bit nearer solution by historians have shifted the date of King Alfred's death back from 901 to 899. You've got three more years, you see, for the Edwardian pieces of Coverdale to have been struck in. But Coverdale has not found, I think, its solution. And you won't expect any very intelligent remarks about it to be made. But this new Maury St. Peter find, of course, Derwent say it does show what the normal currency of Eastern England was in 925, in contrast to Coverdale, which would anyone regard it nowadays as a normal sample of the Anglo-Saxon currency. Well now, I suppose the essential problem, which one day will be resolved, of the Alfredian and Edwardian coins, is to fit the miscellaneous information supplied by an embarrassing multitude of pieces into a framework of history which is mainly drawn from annals relating to southern England. Monsieur Curdale, Mollis and Peter, they illustrate parts of England which in the early 900s were living their own lives in their own way. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle was written, at any rate, in Wessex. It's very hard to bring those two forms of information, you know, into a coherent focus. But the time will come when that is done, and we shall know something about the culture and more about the racial composition, thanks to the money's names, of the peoples who appear vaguely in English sources, as the armies of Northumbria, the armies of East Anglia, and the armies of the boroughs of the adjacent Midlands.
They have a successful way of dealing with the problem of young love. They don't allow it. Young men and young women are simply not permitted to spend time together alone until marriage. We pressed them to admit to secret yearnings, but no, they said love affairs were out of the question, so they put them out of their mind.
BBC Television's Love Law is just one of the items enjoyed again in Margaret Howard's Pick of the Week at 11:15. Now, at 10:15, it's time for The Archers.
Finally, I would say that the most serious hindrance to an understanding of the earlier history of the English currency, and I'm not forgetting the many problems of the early southern coinage, their Merovingian affiliations, but the most serious hindrance to our understanding of the earlier problems of a currency is the absence of any chronicle that can be regarded as contemporary, covering the Midlands and the South in the second half of the 8th century. That is the Age of Arthur, the age in which the continuous history of the English currency begins. Anyone who's tried to write the history of that period, tried to teach it, tried to think about it, is by the fact that the reign of Offer is only illustrated for us today by a collection of bits and pieces. King Offer was the greatest English king, I must, out of respectability, say, except Alfred. You can take that as bread. And, as a great scholar has recently observed, Dr. Sisson, he had every quality of a great king, except a biographer. Well, no collection of people like this, no collection of numismatists will underestimate the importance of Offa. And there is no revolution in the demonstrable history of the English currency comparable to the passage from the unsigned coinage which we can conveniently describe as the coinage of shatters, to the signed currency bearing the name of King Offa. emphasizing his royal dignity and recording, and indeed they deserve recording, the names of his maniers. The coins have, of course, always been studied intensively, and I will take it that the main facts about them are well known. Their significance in the history of the English currency has always been recognized. Their artistic merit has always been acknowledged, sometimes overstressed. And the question of their relationship to the signed, or at least initialed, silver coinage introduced across the Channel by Pippin, King of the Franks, has given rise to much inquiry. But for me at least, it does not seem that these amazing coins have yet been firmly incorporated into the general history of their time. And in particular, no convincing answer, so far as I know, has been given to the fundamental question: why Offa should have chosen to display on his coins with such uncompromising emphasis his name, his title, and his dignity. You can't say simply Offa was a very great king and expressed his greatness in this way. After all, his predecessor, King Ethelbald of Mercia, who called himself Rex Britanni on at least one of his charters, is recorded by Bede as ruler of all the English peoples south of the Humber. In mere power, it would have been perfectly possible for Ethelbald to have issued a coinage as remarkable as that of Offa. Now, these studies are moving so fast that one may easily be out of date. But the view I've gathered from writing this about Offa's coins is that numismatists would tend to bring them all into the second half of the reign. That they follow upon the conquest of Kent by Offa in a battle fought at Oxford, in the year which the annalistic date can be corrected to 776. And that the coinage of Offa starts at any rate as a coinage in Kent. And I'm not concerned to dispute that opinion now. But what I am concerned to dispute, you know, is that there's any evidence, anything you call tolerable evidence, for a conquest of Kent by Offa in the Battle of Oxford, 776. Because it is recorded, true enough, that the Mercians and Kentish men fought at Oxford in that year, but it isn't stated who won the battle. And the annal which records this battle which is made quite pivotal for him work on offer. It's a very curious one. It doesn't give the name of either of the leaders of the armies, which is very unusual, you know, in the early annals of Dutch battle. And it belongs to a part of the Anglo-Saxon chronicle, which, I think myself, was written as a filling to join the earliest West Saxon annals, which really do seem to go back to the early 8th century, with the familiar Alfredian chronicle, which we possess. Maybe annal itself is just a little bit odd. In this year, doesn't it read? In this year, Red Cross was seen in the sky at sundown. And the Mercians and Kentish men fought at Oxford. And wonderful snakes were seen in Sussex. And even though the chronology of the Corians of Offa. And in case I may be understressing, or should I say overstressing, the deficiencies of the chronicle, I think if you trace the documents showing Offa and power in Kent, you will find the charter from 764 showing him an authority in Kent. In 765, you can see him at Peterborough confirming the charter of a minor Kentish king. And in 774, you have two charters of his giving Kentish land to the Archbishop of Canterbury. After that, you have no evidence that he had any authority in Kent for a period of something like 10 years after the Battle of Oxford, whatever its result may have been. Then the series takes up again. Of course, the end of his reign, he was Lord of Kent, as he was Lord of everywhere else in England. Therefore, retaining, and I don't want to upset accepted doctrine, but retaining the Kentish origin of Offa's earliest pieces, portrait pieces. Retaining that, I don't know any reason why they shouldn't have been struck at least as early as 764, when the first of Offa's Kentish charters was issued. Now, if that's so, it gives us more elbow room for the distribution of Offa's coins. And I think it offers, in a rate, a faint light on the circumstances in which Offa took that momentous step of issuing signed coinage, emphatically, really flamboyantly, emphasizing his royal dignity. Now I will come at once to a suggestion which most appeals to me. I believe that in thus proclaiming his royal dignity, which, let's remember, was an unprecedented step in England. Offa was deliberately emphasizing his position as a hereditary king, in contrast to the position of the new dynasty, noble but not royal, which had recently come into power among the Franks. In 751, the ancient line of the Merovingian kings came to an end. The Merovingian kings, as we all know, were really ostentatiously archaic in their habits and behavior. All their hair long, drove about the country in farm carts. They are truly your very typical half-divine barbarian sovereigns. As individuals, they had their failings. And in 751, after one previous unsuccessful attempt, because people like to have these curiosities circulating through the country, after an unsuccessful attempt with the authority of the Pope and through the agency of our very remarkable Englishman, Boniface, the last of the line, the Merovingian line, was deposed and Pippin, mayor of the palace, the Frankish kingdom, was consecrated king. Just allow me, as an outsider, to say, I do hope that those who write the name of Pippin will spell it in the good old Germanic way, P-I-P-P-I-N, and not P-E-P-I-N, or worse, P-accented E. P-I-N. I mean, it's a lovely Germanic capitalistic name, of course, Pippin, but farewell. Well, this family, from which, of course, Charlemagne comes, was noble, was ancient, but it was not royal. And the family of which Charlemagne was, the family of which Offa was the head, was not only royal, but traced its royal descent back to the kings, and in particular to a king who was Offa's namesake, who were ruling over the Anglian people on the continent before the migration to Britain. After the disappearance of the Merovingians, in descent, Offa had no rival among, at any rate, the Western kings of his time. And his subjects respect for that descent, well, it's well recorded in English epic poetry, of in Waitsith and in Beowulf, references made to Offa's ancestor, Offa, sometimes called the greatest race of men between the seas, which I suppose means of the whole world, or is praised for having struck out a permanent boundary between his kingdom and its neighbors. One would think, in offering you this suggestion, that offer was expressing his position as a hereditary king in his court. One was being fanciful, but the two facts. One of them is that undoubtedly offer's sense of his royalty, his royal ancestry, governed his reaction to Charlemagne's later proposal for a marriage alliance between their families. Charlemagne, this is recorded in a chronicle written, if I remember rightly, in 839, derived from a man who had known both Charlemagne and Offa. Charlemagne demanded the daughter of Offa in marriage for one of his sons. Now, marriage like that would have been treating Offa as a subject, or at least an inferior king. Offa, of course, replies that he will not agree to this marriage unless, of course, Charlemagne gives one of his daughters to Offa's son, Ichfrith. Well, that is a definite declaration that Offa regards himself as in this sphere of royalty, at least the equal of Charlemagne. Charlemagne is, of course, such a patriarch that it's hard to realize that a king like Offa, who is much more obscure, could have kept himself on equal terms. Still less that he could have regarded himself as a person of ancient family might regard men newly come to riches. Now, it's always dangerous to attribute ideas and motives to statesmen who have left no written materials under their own hands. The heart of kings is inscrutable. But by most fortunate chance, one of those chances which make early history possible, we possess a piece of definite evidence that the distinction and the royal distinction of Offa's family was in his mind at the time of his first recorded visit to Canterbury in 764. The earliest date, I think, at which Offa's new coinage could have been issued on any considerable scale. In that year, at Canterbury, first time we know he was there, he issues a charter granting the large estate near the Medway to Eardulf, Bishop of Rochester. And he actually styles himself in the body of the charter, "I offer, King of the Mercians, sprung from the royal stock of the Mercians." And remember, the royal stock of the Mercians means a family
going back in royalty
to the prehistoric Germanic foreword upon the continent, I offer King of the Mercians, Goli Prosapia Mercioli, Oriandus. If that isn't a definite insistence that the royalty which offer is assertive, is a royalty which all his subjects, perhaps especially the followers and fighting men who accompanied him as they accompanied every other king, which they would regard as superlative. Now the charter, unhappily we haven't the original of it, but it's preserved in the most trustworthy of English cartularies, the Textus Ruffensis. It contains ancient formulas which you get in earlier Kentish charters brought, as I would think, by Archbishop Theodore from the continent. And the clinching point of its authenticity, it is witnessed by a Kentish king named Feachbert, H-E-A-B-E-R-H-T. He appears in three charters as a sub-king in Kent. And he, I think one may say this, he follows his overlord's example in the issue of coins. One of those coins has been preserved. May not be a beautiful coin, so the pieces that were bitten out of it, but the name H-E-A-B-E-R-H-T is legible to all who can read an alphabet in capital. That, then, is the suggestion that I would put on the table for consideration by those who in the future may be concerned with offers coins. Accepting the Kentish origin, I would suggest that this new type was issued as soon as Offa was firmly in the saddle in his own kingdom and as overlord of the seven English people. And that, I don't think, happened for 5 or 6, or perhaps more, years after his accession in 757. I believe that in issuing these coins, he was definitely asserting his equality with, if not his superiority, over the more powerful but less august dynasty which had lately come into power in France. And in that rivalry, in that attitude, I think we have the real reason for the change which starts the English currency on its permanent course. And I think it is unnecessary to look any further for the origin of the characteristic features which give to office coins the unique interest to the numismatist as to the historian.